And Services Committee together. Hello? Thank you. Now, if you turn off your cell phones and your Blackberries and all those other devices, that would be wonderful. Okay, we're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 766, and we will open the public hearing. Would you tell us about Senate Bill
766? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 766 allows the Department of Human Services to make grants to and enter into contracts with private nonprofit organizations for the purpose of providing services to individuals with disabilities. It specifies the areas of services which grants can be awarded to provide, appropriates money from the general fund to DHS to distribute as a grant award. It declares an emergency, takes effect July 1st, 2007. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. David Bean and D.C. Winters, would you please come up? Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Speaker and the Chairman, everybody.
Identify yourself.
My name's David Bean. I'm an advocate for disability people in the state of Oregon,
okay.
And they got no services. I've been helping them in the state of Oregon. I'd like to see the legislature will fund this program. I've been doing this till 1999. Now I've been working for all the different agencies in the state, and every mayor in the state. But the debate of the first one in the state will run it is resources. Nobody will touch that for the programs. Because some of the disability people don't trust the system. Don't trust me because I've been institutionalized most of my life with a little kid. Mm-hmm. And I think that it should work. Mistake.
Okay. Thank you very much, David.
My name is D.C. Winters, and I'm assistant advocate with David Beam.
Okay.
Been working with David since at least 94, and I know he's been advocating since 1969 when he graduated from Fairview Training Center.
Okay.
And as we've he's told me that there's many times he can't sleep during the night. People call him up and say, hey, I need help, because
mm-hmm.
they don't have a safe place to be, which that's why his phone is still unlisted to this day, because those needs are still not being met. I mean, there's just the need is so broad, it's like, where do you begin?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Solicitor General of the United States told the U.S. Supreme Court, the discrimination against people with disability is so wide that it affects everything. When it affects everything, where do you start? You start with the present crisis, whatever it happens to be. I mean, when David found the blind, deaf, mute mother with a baby
mm-hmm.
in here in downtown Salem at the city bus chariot system, it's like, where does he get help for?
Mm-hmm.
Touch sign language is the only way she communicates. The local women's crisis center, they wouldn't touch her because they didn't know how to communicate with her. And when he took her to the local government, I mean to the city governor's office, it was the end of Kitts Hopper's administration at the time, and it was like shuffling her to different agencies, they didn't want to deal with her. It's like, we'll help the baby. She can come back later. And it was, and that situation hasn't changed. And whether it be whatever kind of crisis it is, after 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
and on weekends, there is not the crisis help that there should be available for them to be safe
mm-hmm.
in a situation. If you're fleeing from domestic violence, where do they go? Where can they go?
Now, how do you envision this program working?
Well, it'll have to be coordinated and cooperating with other available services. If there's a place for someone, if they're already connected with support services,
mm-hmm.
you find answers there. But a lot of them are on waiting lists and don't have the kind of services that they need from anyone. And so if they need immediate help, you deal with the immediate help, shelter housing, immediately. And just, you try to network with what's available. If it's not, well, then you have to create an answer.
Okay. But if, for instance, after 5 p.m. or on the weekend, and you find an individual who needs help, the example that was given earlier, the woman who couldn't communicate, what do you do under this program? Where do you go? Where is the do you have a crisis center in each and every community? Do you have a coordinator?
Well, ideally, there's going to have to be centers in county or count in each area.
Okay.
Ideally, you should have them in every county.
Yeah.
But at least, like in the Portland area, you'd have to deal with what's available.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no way you can create, the taxpayers are not going to pay enough taxes to create something new. You have to find a way to use available resources and network to make it happen in an affordable way. Because spending $35,000 would be way too much, but there are ways to get that expense much lower by networking and to mentoring and to have a crisis center or consumer-run type facility where they mentor one another. And so you're dealing with peer-level people with help from professionals.
So what you're saying is that the infrastructure may be in place already as far as the nonprofits are already existing, and you need a coordination?
Some of them exist, but there are times, like the blind lady, no place would touch her. So you have to, to take care of her until you connect to elements where she can be helped.
Okay. But are you saying that the crisis center would be a place that would be accessible 24 hours a day to find information on where to go? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that would be one element. There would also be, the facility would have to function because they would have to have a place for them to be temporarily.
Okay.
It's a shelter.
Yeah.
And so finding that kind of help, you have to actually have a place. Because a place like the Union Gospel Mission or the Salem Outreach Center, they're not prepared to deal with people in that kind of crisis.
Okay. Okay. This is a huge... I think it's a very good idea and a relatively simple idea. The implementation might be quite large, and that's what we're here to talk about and to explore. Other questions? Yes, Senator George.
I head down?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Senator George is going to join you in his testimony.
You know David? Sorry, I'm glad you're here.
I'm glad you have leadership.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes. For the record, State Senator Gary George, representing District 12. A few years ago, when Bill Fisher was chairing a similar committee, and we had DHS before us, we were talking about the reform. And the interesting thing was that day is we heard one comment that has stayed with me ever since, and that was, we're going to develop a one-stop shopping, particularly to be able to take care of the disabled and those needy within the communities. And the person saw me looking at a paper and made a comment that has really stayed with me, and that was, yes, Senator George, we made the same pledge 10 years before on the last reform. Now, my problem is I don't think we're there yet. And what my vision of this is that a demonstration project, maybe one or two of these drop-in centers being set up. Now, to give you an example, the federal government moved forward, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong here, with one available for Hispanics. Disabled Hispanics. And so there's a few models out there that we could take a look at. But the main thing that we've come to the conclusion is that when you have a person, particularly a disabled person, who is in emergency crisis need, and I've actually personally as a senator run into this, there's nowhere for them to go. If we had police officers in here today, they will tell you they don't know what to do about the problems. And the question has always been, and David's plan to me in your bill offers that opportunity, is to have many of the disabled people managing that system. In other words, they know what the needs are. They know how to address this. As David does currently, he's out there trying to meet the needs of this unmet population anyway. But I would like to again go back just a few years ago when I held committee. In fact, I believe we were, in B, hearing room B, and on special education. And you know what we found? As David said here, we are obligated to provide these services. It isn't a you shall or you might. I mean, it is not a you might, but it is absolutely a requirement of federal law that you meet the needs. We fail to do that. We don't meet those needs, particularly on these after-hour type scenario. Also, I really believe there's part of the solution lies in the fact that people who are disabled need to be able to interact with folks who may, in fact, know exactly what they're going through because they're disabled. Mm-hmm. I think the opportunity for this thing to be well-managed and well-run and really meet the needs of that community, as David and both of the Davids on both sides of me here have found out, mm-hmm. is that this is not being met anywhere in the United States. And it's an opportunity for Oregon maybe to be a leader in an area of finally stepping up and saying we're going to deal with a disabled population. And that is to integrate all of these services, to provide the connectivity to all of the things that might be beneficial, to stabilize them. As I was reading your bill, Mr. Chairman, I said that's exactly what we need, finding the appropriate therapy, finding the appropriate connection, the appropriate housing, and whatever it may be, to deal with a disabled population. A few years ago, I was helping a friend of mine, and we were Seattle MAC. And now you're going to ask, what does that have to do with this? And we noticed that underneath Highway 5, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people. And I said to one of the guys that worked there at Seattle MAC, this is late in the evening, actually early morning, when we were there, I said, what is this? And they said, these are disabled Washingtonians who don't have a place to live. And they literally were living under the Highway 5 freeway where it's suspended in that area as you approach downtown Seattle. And I thought, there's nobody in this society would approve of that because this is a group of people who need services. Every person, no matter what their political or religious philosophy, believes that the needs of this group should be met. I think this bill is a great step forward. If it has minor fiscal implications, tell me what the implications are if we don't meet the needs of this population. They're great because they may end up in the hands of the police, into our judiciary system. They don't belong there. They need services, and they need their needs met.
So you're perhaps suggesting a pilot project, to do an amendment.
We have to keep the cost down.
Yes.
One thing, it's so simple I forgot to mention.
Now, introduce yourself again for the record.
One additional thing I just remembered. My name is D.C. Winters, assistant to David Bain. Mr. Chair, the one thing that needs to be clear that most people aren't aware of is that many of the people cannot read or write more than their own name or counter-manage their own money. And when you add that factor, if they can't read and write, how are they supposed to find help or even learn where to find help? They need an alternative form of communication, pictures, word pictures they can understand, even if they can't read. I don't know what percentage of the special needs people are in jail, but the people that work in the jail tell me that on the average, 75% of the people in jail do not know how to read and write.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I say something?
Introduce yourself again.
My name's David Beam. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Barbara Roberts, and she said this is to be the first one in this history of Oregon would put up where the money is mm-hmm. and get it started. Because their son's a Down syndrome person.
Thank you.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. Mary Lee Fry. Bill Dalton. Now we should probably.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. I have provided written testimony, so I will try and keep my comments brief. Many of the issues that you heard Mr. Bean, David, and DC talk about certainly are critical issues for persons with developmental disabilities. But a service center that is proposed to be created could run the risk of actually creating more duplication in an existing service. We currently contract with county mental health and developmental disability programs to provide case management, access to services, eligibility, crisis management, and then in the last 4 years, as a result of this daily settlement, we have included 9 service brokerages, which are working with individuals who are adults with developmental disabilities, not in one of our comprehensive group homes, and doing individual planning. So the number of organizations that already exist, I think, are an important factor. And when you're dealing with an issue as important as crisis and crisis management, trying to come up with yet another service entity can create confusion at a time where people really need to be very clear on where people need to go to. So although we certainly agree that the issues of crisis management, access to shelter, access to services are very important, we're not in support of setting up another entity. One last comment I would make is that currently we have federal match for many of the services that we currently do, from case management to the brokerage service, support services, and all of those items are listed in our home and community-based waiver. It's possible that these services would be seen as a duplication, and getting federal match for services would be a concern.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
You know, I appreciate what you're saying, but I just have one question for you. Are you telling me that we're meeting the needs of this community 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm saying that the systems that are in place with the counties to at least be able to respond to some crisis are there. That if we end up setting up a separate service as well, the trying to meet those needs in two different places will create even more confusion.
You didn't answer my question.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I don't believe that we are meeting all the needs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Thank you. I was going to ask that question. And I do know the services are there if they're accessible, if there's someone around in 5 to 9 during the week is one situation. The reason I chose to introduce this bill was because I felt that it did propose something in addition to what exists, and we're in search of that. Of that, I think a pilot project would be in order in terms of trying to, you know, both in terms of a fiscal and in terms of trying to figure out if it does actually duplicate or if it does prove that it facilitates people that have nowhere else to go. Now, I envision a phone bank. Well, let me restate that. Perhaps where the crisis center would be is to have access to the services at 10:30 on a Sunday night or a Saturday night, and someone comes in, whoever's there says, okay, I know where to connect you. But I understand what you're saying. Yeah, we don't want to duplicate services. We want to enhance the services.
And Mr. That's Chairman, what we're searching for. You can't duplicate something you're not doing.
Oh, okay.
And if I could really quickly to ask this question of you, since you're the minister of this idea of the service, are you familiar with that Hispanic drop-in center for disabled, supposedly here in Salem.
Chair Morissette, Senator George, you may be referring to Juntos Podemos.
I have no idea.
Is actually a family support program. It's not a crisis center, and it is a program that has been working with individuals who are using some of the family support dollars that are available to help with respite, families who require respite. They do a number of bartering of being able to expand the opportunities for respite way beyond what the state can support for actually the funding of respite. So it's not a emergency crisis. I don't believe it's open, certainly not 24 hours, and I'm not even sure 7 days a week.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
It's too bad I didn't invite both you and Senator George to my committee meeting this morning. Senator Cruz was there, where we had community mental health as our topic. And, of course, this would include disabilities. But it was just informational hearings, because we are trying to look at how we can system-wide develop crisis management teams, respite centers, transitional housing, and mental health facilities for those who are in need, whether it's primarily for those who are in crisis. And I am truly encouraged by the energy and the positive feedback that we were getting from all the agencies. So it does cost money, mm-hmm. But we do need a statewide plan that doesn't duplicate. I'm not sure this does duplicate, but this bill would go right along with what we are trying to attempt to do with mental health community-wise. So it won't hurt to get it at least down into Ways and Means.
Chair Morissette and Senator Monis Anderson, the speaking for developmental disabilities, and I recognize this bill extends to the populations beyond developmental disabilities, but it also includes persons with mental health needs. But in the developmental disabilities community, we do have a contract with each county for what we call short-term diversion. And those are funds that the counties can use to immediately assist in someone who is in a crisis. It's often what they're using it for is providing a foster care service, or they may buy in-home staffing to go into a family home. It's often respite, and they have access to these funds for 120 days while they plan and say, is this something that is going to be a long-term need, or is this really short-term need? The counties operate as a region, and so the counties have staff that cover five different areas of the state doing this. But it's not a 24-hour 7 in terms of it's not available on to take calls that are in crisis at night. They are indeed working with individuals that have come through either hotlines and are responding to them during the time. So there are a number of resources that I think we have tried to address and bring to the table to assist with many of the individuals who indeed end up in crisis in our system.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bircher.
All right. Thank you very much. You know, you have a huge job to do, and I just wonder if simplistically at some point in time a group of smart people like yourselves just sit down and say, this is a population that we have to serve, and this is how much money we have to do it. Is going through the counties the best way? Now, it might be. I'm not saying that it's not. I'm just saying that sometimes I get the feeling as an elected official that we have so many unmet needs with people because of the huge load that I get that comes to me. And in turn, I go to the agency people and I bring it to them. I had a situation not long ago over a weekend, and I tried desperately to get somebody in the local office, but there's no message machine that says if this is an emergency, call such and such. There's nothing, and so I had to wait until Monday through a crisis situation with an elderly individual, well known to the people. And I really, if I could have gotten to them, they have unlisted phone numbers. I'm talking about employees, which I don't blame them. But if I could have gotten to them, they would have helped me. And I, together, we could have helped the situation that we had. It disturbs me that you have people coming to elected people like myself that are in really bad straits who have so many multiple needs. The one-stop shopping idea has worked at the Newmark Center, which you probably are very familiar with other kinds of services where you have agencies all in one building and somebody can go in and go from door to door, and that helps. But I'm more intrigued by what DC said about consumer operated. And now it would have to have some supervision. But there is a real rationale, as Senator George pointed out, that people who are involved in a particular situation know how to deal with that situation best. Mm-hmm. And so there are many people that could help that are not as limited as others, who could probably provide quite a good service. Now, how you would put all that together, I don't know. But I will tell you that as hard as your employees work, there are a lot of people out there. And our chair mentioned not long ago, it looks like we're going to go back to having poor farms, which is really scary in this day and age that we had so many people that don't have the means of heating their home or don't have a home or they're hungry. And I think as policy people, we're just trying to be a partner with you in figuring out the best way. So I would appreciate any comments you might have about even the addition of an emergency number for people like me that are trying to help and assist over weekends would be very beneficial.
Chair Morsett, Senator Berger, I agree being able to have responses is really important. And the more local, the better that is. And I do know in some parts of the state, that at least in the county mental health and developmental disability systems have worked together to man a hotline on the weekends and deal with that. But I don't know that that's a statewide practice. And certainly it's an important one. I also would like to comment about the importance of having people with disabilities who self-advocates who can really assist in policy making and assist in that. And it's something that we do indeed believe in very much. We fund an organization called Self-Advocates as Leaders to help with us on many of the policy making strategies that we're involved in. And I think your comments would be good for us to take back and further look at how else we could address those issues.
Follow up, Mr. Yes. Chair. And I in no way mean to offer this as criticism. I'm here as a partner. I certainly don't have all the answers or the solutions. If I did, I'd write them all down and hand you the piece of paper. But I think that all I'm trying to lift up in this situation is that a bill like this comes forward mainly because of necessity, and they see it, and we see it at the local level.
Good. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Dalton from Salem, Oregon. I'm here as a colleague of Mr. Winters and Mr. Beam, and I say that with a great deal of pride. I've known them for a lot of years, and in my capacity as a former mental health program director and also an ongoing advocate in the field of disabilities and mental health, it's been a pleasure working with them. It's a little scary because you never know who you're going to be called up to the table with. You know, I didn't know whether to do this or do this. But the truth is I'm extremely encouraged by all of what I've heard this afternoon. I apologize. I was a little late. I have a daytime job that pays, so I had to scurry away. I have a vision that I think is not very different than a combination of the pieces that have been shared by the members of the committee, and I find that very exciting. Having been a mental health program director in Washington State as well as for nearly 15 years here in Oregon, I have an appreciation for the problems of thinning the soup. If there was an extra $2 million around, I bet you and your program staff could use that very well to answer already identified needs. We certainly had that issue in the county, and I have a great deal of respect and long support for the current system of contracting with counties. So I am out, I think, like the committee, to find resolution and solutions that don't involve the expenditure of a great deal of money and certainly don't involve duplication of services. That would be a travesty in this day and age for a variety of reasons. What we have, as far as my experience, and it's broad but nowhere near as broad as a combination of the people that you have an opportunity to hear before your committee, but we have some excellent models of a variety of interventive services. The contracting with the counties, the implementation of after-hours crisis services, which, by the way, was modeled to a good extent in Josephine County, and I'm very proud of that. The very strong cooperation between developmental disabilities and mental health, which has survived changes in how the Department of Human Services has been organized and reorganized over the eons. I'm very proud of that. The fact that consumers have been increasingly recognized for their value at policy level as well as program implementation level. Again, I'm very proud of the fact that the peer support program was developed and modeled initially in Josephine County for mental and emotional disturbance. I have seen really good people put together some really excellent systems. And yet, even after all of these years, 30 years pretty much in the state of Oregon, I'm sad to be able to say amen to what Mr. Beam and Mr. Winters and yourselves as committee participants have been able to share, and that is there are terrible gaps in the system. What I see, and it may, Senator Morissette, come somewhat close to what I heard you share as some of your vision, what I see is a model demonstration program that would be anything but a cookie cutter. Whatever county or even small group of counties you might choose as the demonstration site, and I think some of the best of what we've seen in demonstrations is by putting out an RFP and seeing who steps forward with the best, most effective, cost-efficient proposal. But I think it should be up to those counties to take a look at what systems they have in place and to do the basics of a good continuous quality improvement-based assessment of what do we do when one of our county officials gets a call on Friday night. What do we do when Mr. Beam gets a call saying that we have a blind, mute woman with a young child who is stuck here in Salem and has no way of communicating her needs, much less no obvious service available to her? I think on the county level, or maybe even a sub-county level, if you're dealing with a county as large as Multnomah County, for instance, I think the service providers, the good service providers that we have who are already associated with DHS and affiliated agencies, can sit down and problem solve that. I'm looking at programs like CASA. I'm looking at programs based on an ombudsman kind of model. I'm looking at programs that have worked out written guidelines and arrangements among agencies so that basically what we're developing is a safety net for the very kind of people that you have heard shared with you this afternoon and that you have all experienced who fall through the cracks in our very hard-working systems. The systems that aren't necessarily available after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. My kind of mental health crisis services, who once they've responded to the crisis, need some place to turn to take the person in need. And I'll tell you, those well-trained mental health workers who are sensitive to mental, emotional, and developmental disabilities at 1 o'clock in the morning get in exactly the same quandary that you are in, Senator Verger. They don't know what number to call at midnight for the particular needs that they've identified. But I think we can put together a demonstration project or two that would give us a model that could then be shared throughout the state. And I think it would be a model that would do the best of tying together in an effective fashion the services that we currently have so that we're not duplicating them, we're not spending a great deal of money, and we're making the very best use we can of the people that are often most sensitive to these issues, who are those with already identified disabilities who are willing to step forward and help us out of this quandary. So I'm here to speak in favor of the bill, and not only to speak in favor of it conceptually, but to say that I, too, have in my head the beginnings of a dream for how this could be accomplished, not in some highfalutin fashion, but by simply getting together the good people we already have in the system. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions? I really appreciate that, and what I would like to do is think some more about the possibilities of this bill, to make it a doable bill, to make it a demonstration project that works, because I think Senator Mona Sanderson heard some testimony this morning dealing with mental health crisis that parallel with our conversation, and so I think that there is the germ of a workable idea as a demonstration project on a limited basis to see, to demonstrate that it can work, and then to go forth and do good from there. So I would like to do that, and don't go away until you give us your information and where we can find you.
I'm not leaving because okay. I'm really interested in seeing if I can be a part, especially
oh, yes.
if we
yeah.
do it in Salem.
Yeah,
I would love to be a part
okay.
of helping to put that
good.
Together.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing. Thank you very much, and we will work on this bill. We'll come back. Thank you very much, Phil. Okay, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 792. Would you give us an overview, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 792 appropriates money to the Department of Human Services to be used to fund the Retired and Senior Volunteer Services Program. It specifies that funds can be used to provide seniors with volunteer experiences in their communities in areas including the provision of support services to seniors and persons with disabilities, academic tutoring, mentoring and social support in public schools and community colleges, and community policing, crime prevention, and safety for senior citizens and persons with disabilities. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007, and it also has subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you. Jim Davis, are you still here? You're still here. Beth Fox? Nicole, could you come up also, please? Thank you. Jim, would you like to lead off?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee. I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon Association for Retired and Senior Volunteer Programs and our 15 RSVP program affiliates around the state. I'm also representing partners who are working with us on this endeavor, Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, Save Oregon Seniors, and United Seniors of Oregon. And we are here to urge the committee to support Senate Bill 792 that calls for the continued funding of the RSVP state projects for the 2007-2009 biennium. But what we're also here to talk about is our heartfelt desire to raise the amount of state project money that is currently being allotted to these state projects. It was in our notes to legislative council, but this year they were not putting numbers in these bills. What you would have seen would be $450,000. We are currently getting $275,000. But 12 years ago, when we pulled off our little miracle and were able to get through the legislature $250,000 in funding for the state RSVP projects, during that time, those 12 years, we have increased $25,000. So there's been virtually no increases. We've been on just about every cut list that has ever existed because of our general fund dollars. So we've really just been trying to fight for our existence, and now we would like to see the program at least have some minimal growth as to how it would have grown in times when we have a little more economic health. But the 15 state projects have done a wonderful job and have had great impact throughout the state. During this 12-year time period, we've been awarded $1.7 million in state funds, and as I said, $275,000 in the current budget. And through that, we've been able to create cost-effective, innovative approaches to utilizing RSVP volunteer support within the senior and disability community, public schools, community colleges, and crime prevention agencies. The projects have had three major goals. One is social services to seniors and people with disabilities. It is housed in SPD. Academic tutoring and mentoring to young people in the public schools and in the community colleges, and community policing and senior crime prevention programs. As you can see in the testimony that we've handed to you, we have been keeping fairly accurate running totals of volunteers, trying to keep it as clean as possible in terms of just new volunteers coming in and how many actually unduplicated volunteers have been involved with the projects during that 12-year period. Since the program's inception, we've involved more than 6,500 volunteers in the projects, more than 150,000 children and seniors have been provided with services. That doesn't count our Justice Department hotline. We staff the Justice Department hotline, and through that we've had contact with over 400,000 people, but it kind of skews our data, so we keep that separate. But if you were to calculate the number of hours, there's been 900,000 hours put in by our state projects in that 12 years, you would have in excess of over $13 million and services for what has been a very minimal investment on the part of taxpayers. So that's something we are very proud of. As you can see, we've broken down in terms of the number of volunteers that we have serving in the school systems, and that has been 2,500 mentors and tutors have given 380,000 volunteer hours and served 49,000 students. Within the social services, and in that, not only the Justice Hotline, but we have friendly visitation programs, peer counseling programs, dial-a-ride programs, building handicap ramps, community education, a number of different things that our people are doing. We have reached more than 48,000 Oregon citizens. 280,000 hours of volunteer service in the social service system alone involves 1,760 volunteers. And then within community safety, and Beth has a wonderful community safety program down in the Lynn Benton area, we've been able to involve nearly 2,000 volunteers for 150,000 hours and 45,000 seniors reached with home safety checks and the crime prevention assistance programs and the SALT programs, which have been very, very effective. So now, as we're beginning to recuperate from some of the budget cuts of the past, it's really a time to begin to expand the volunteer involvement of these very, very effective volunteers. And they've been kind of filling the gaps in services where needed. And so we urge you to not only support this measure, but also to support, you know, a moderate level of increase in the funding of these projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, first of all, what's the Justice Hotline?
the Justice Department hotline is run, you know, in cooperation. Actually, AARP has been a very active partner in that, but we have been able to supply RSVP volunteers to the Justice Department hotline, and they answer calls that come in from consumers. So consumers call in with complaints or problems, and they're able to take those and write up reports and then get responses from within the Justice Department. It's been very effective.
Okay, thank you. Now, do your volunteers, are they available? What's the availability of a volunteer in terms of numbers of hours and time of day and so on and so forth? I
mean, well, probably some of those questions that would answer most appropriately, but it's pretty much up to the volunteer how much time they want to commit to. You know, and there's a wide range of hours that are being put in by different volunteers.
Tell me about the developmentally disabled community. Do you have volunteers from that community? Do you have volunteers for that community?
RSVP volunteers, Senator Morsette, need to be 55 and above.
Okay.
So individuals with disabilities would be warmly welcome and for involvement. And there are a number that are involved in RSVPs, but there is the 55-year-old age limit.
What about the time of day availability of a volunteer? Is it a 5 to 9 during the week, or is it...
There's more of a wide range of volunteer involvement. So
Beth, you want to introduce yourself, please?
Good afternoon. Good afternoon to all of you. Thank you, Senator Morsette, for your question. My name is Beth Fox. I'm the director of the Lynn Benton RSVP. I've been there for almost 7 years. Senator Morissette's area covers part of our region up there in Sweet Home. And to answer your question about how do we serve the disabled population, it varies somewhat. There are 15 RSVPs in the state of Oregon. We cover 19 counties. And each individual program is able to select some of the areas of interest according to the needs and the gaps in their community. So I can tell you one thing that we do very practically for a organization that serves the disabled population is our volunteers are getting together tomorrow to do a mass bulk mailing for Home Life in Corvallis, which is a home setting for people that have developmental disabilities. These are very practical ways that we can support those nonprofits to help them save money on their FTE and their expenses. We do have volunteer programs. For example, we have a senior peer counseling program. We also have a home inspection program. And the home inspection program says on paper that we serve people that are 55 and up, but we have been called by people who have both physical and mental disabilities for home inspections, and that's where I, as director, can bend the rules a little bit and say, yes, this is an important population for us to serve as well.
Now, you were here when we had the previous testimony and the previous bill, and if you got a call from David at midnight asking you to find a place for a person to go, or if one of your volunteers did, would they be remotely involved in helping to find a spot? Does your program have boundaries of types of service?
Senator Morsette, we receive calls every day regarding areas that we don't necessarily serve directly, but one of the things that we did 2 years ago was we created a resource guide. Now, what I'd love to see statewide, get me on one of these committees, is something that's virtual, something on the internet where you could go if you got a call like that and you'd know where to recommend people. We created this manual, this resource guide that has that type of information so that we can help refer people to the appropriate nonprofit organization in our area. Even if it's something that we are not experts in, we know the nonprofits in our area, so we can refer appropriately. And oftentimes there are two different, you know, places that might be appropriate referrals. The area of folks with mental disabilities and homelessness is just huge, and that's an area that I would say the senior volunteers are not as active in, but there might be one here and there that might take a leadership role. It's not our average age volunteer right now is 75 years old, and so that's one of our issues.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Beth, one of the things that I find with dealing with people trying to help them, particularly where they're for instance, they would call you.
Yes.
And you, in good intentions, would tell them that was not an area that you handled, and you would try to find a person for them to go to. They feel that they're being just shuffled from place to place, and that people don't want to deal with them, so they're sending them some other place. That isn't necessarily true, but that's the feeling they get, and perception's everything. And so the ombudsman approach, I think, seems to work so much better, because that's the person that needs the assistance, and then I'm the person calling and being moved from place to place, and the person needing assistance accepts that, because they don't think they're going to shuffle me around. And I think that it's very difficult for the agencies themselves to handle that and not leave the perception that you're trying to get rid of them.
Senator Berger, you're very right. I have more than once received calls from people who say, you're the first person who's been able to help me because I keep getting passed off. And they've kind of learned to pass off to us. And it's not necessarily an easy thing for us, but I know a lot of the RSVPs, because we work with virtually all the nonprofits in our region, we're very aware of our community and what's going on and
That's
who
right.
can help.
That's right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Good work.
I may be in touch with you also to see how what we were talking about in the last bill can fit into something like you're talking about. Nicole Palmer, go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nicole Palmateer, and I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities.
Nicole, before you start, could you answer a question about what is the name of the network that your predecessor is now working on?
Jacqueline Worth for the Network of Care, Senator Morissette.
It is
the Network of Care. And that is the website that we have for seniors and people with physical disabilities provided through last session's efforts, that is very much what you're speaking of, that is
right.
a virtual resource so you can go on. And I know that they do have a mental health site, and there's been a lot of discussion about making more mental health things available via the internet, just for those kinds of reasons, middle of the night kind of thing.
Ms. Chair, when you mentioned having a place to go,
mm-hmm.
You know, there is one that is now in existence that is absolutely wonderful.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And, more would be better, but what exists is just...
A website?
The website. Yeah. It's extraordinary. It truly is.
Beth, are you familiar with that?
I'm not. Could you share the URL with us all?
it's networkofcare.org.
It's new, and it covers the state, basically, county by county, and it has a list of various agencies and providers and so on.
Services. And
services.
Yeah, it's incredible. It truly is.
It's all one word, Network of Care?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it still has a lot of work. I mean, when I looked up my area, certain areas, they don't have everything there.
But compared to the nothing we did have, it's...
Well, and it's also a work in progress, because we could,
right.
you know, it could be expanded upon, but it is that kind of thing. Nicole, Palmateer, so if you would continue, please.
Sure, I would be delighted to. Members of the committee, we're just here to express our support for the RSVP program. A lot of those programs do function in conjunction with the area agencies on aging, and volunteerism is such an important part of the community. It's important to the person who's volunteering, and the impact on it, you know, is something that we couldn't be able to match with the kinds of funds that we have available in the state. So we just wanted to express our support for this bill.
Thank you very much. Yes. Reintroduce yourself.
I'm Jim Davis with the Oregon Association of RSVPs. I think one other thing that we need to look at with the, you know, looking at trying to expand some of the financial base for this program is the fact that there really is a major effort now being put out by our association and others to begin to reach out to the boomer population, because the base of senior volunteerism is going to change drastically. And, of course, now we're we're already seeing the kind of traditionalist generation is starting. We have an older set of volunteers, and some of those are dying off. Some of the volunteers that we depended on are not there anymore, and we got to start looking at this new boomer generation that's going to explode upon the scene, who led the anti-war movement, who led the women's movement, and to see how that translates into volunteerism. But it'll be a different type of volunteerism, maybe more episodic, maybe, you know, different types of involvements, but that base is going to be critically important, that we have that senior volunteerism base. And one of the interesting issues too is the base of senior volunteer women. And of course, boomer women are very different than their mothers in their involvements, and getting them involved will be different than it has been. So one of the real emphasis that we have put in now and will in the future is beginning to look at how we will involve the boomer population in this new senior volunteer movement.
Mr. Chair, and just follow up on that, I met with three retired nurses who are boomer nurses like I am, and we really are looking at how even all, there are a number of retired nurses that want to look at how they can keep their nursing status in a sense, and we need to motivate them, or at least set up a structure so that they can participate. So there's a whole creative there's a whole lot of creative ideas out there that we somehow need to get a hold of and develop.
Okay. Well, I think we're all basically on the same page, and I guess to me the importance of maintaining volunteers, recruiting volunteers, training volunteers, is the fact that we have staff people to do that. And if we don't have staff people to do it, the whole program is going to go away, and there will be multi-millions of dollars lost in the process, you know, and we can't afford not to support the programs that rely on volunteers. And we just, it's a no-brainer. We just can't afford not to do that. Good. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Lee Gerard and John Mullen, you're batting cleanup, so please come up.
Good afternoon. Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I'm Lee Gerard with Seniors and People with Disabilities, Department of Human Services. You have my written testimony in front of you, so I'm just going to keep my comments really brief. I manage the unit that actually works with the retired senior volunteer programs in distributing the money and receiving reports back and whatnot, so that's the role that I play with this particular program. Seniors and People with Disabilities supports the continued funding of this program. We recognize the importance of community volunteer programs in Oregon and have identified that as a key issue in our draft future of long-term care plan for seniors and people with disabilities for the next 20 years. We recognize that we're not able to address the request for expanded funds, but we do definitely support the continued funding for this service. And if you have any questions, okay. I'm available.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. John?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I was asked to testify today on behalf of this bill, and I'm delighted to do so. And it more has to do with my previous job as director of Clackamas County Social Services, where we provided services and opportunities for elderly people with disabilities and low-income individuals. And we had services and opportunities in our mission statement on purpose because as a community organization, we believed it was not only important to provide those services but give people an opportunity to become involved in decision-making and working in the community. And we took on on with some trepidation a major role in volunteerism because we were a public agency and weren't sure how the public would react to the fact that we were a public agency. Well, it didn't seem to matter at all. In fact, we recruited lots and lots of volunteers. We had about 1,200 volunteers when I left, serving in about 200 locations all around Clackamas County.
Wow.
And the RSVP program itself was our largest program. But there are kind of problems on the horizon, which is why I'm grateful that you're hearing this bill. The federal funding that we received for RSVP was really pretty much static over the years. It didn't change, and the cost of providing services goes up. You have to have staff people. We pay mileage to our volunteers, a variety of things that cost. And so when the state dollars became available, it formed a very important basis of keeping key elements of our RSVP program going. And I'm also delighted to be here today because also Pam Vick is in the audience, who is our volunteer program manager in Clackamas County. She does a wonderful job. We have a lot of different kinds of programs. And the wonderful thing about volunteer programs working in a complex environment is that there's the opportunity for people to get involved that gets the community going and the community in support of what's happening. But it also, on a day-to-day basis, brings so much to the people who are served. And I would just end on the note that just to echo a little bit about what Jim Davis said, another challenge is the demographic changes that we're experiencing. And I would love to see RSVP be the catalyst for reinvigorating and renewing interest in volunteerism and making volunteer opportunities available. In Clackamas County, I know we would work with anybody that would call up and say, I want to volunteer, but these are the circumstances. We would work to find the best placement for that person so they could use their time effectively. And I am a volunteer, as I know many of you are volunteers. People in the audience are volunteers. We just have to have more of it if we want to have the changes in society that we're working towards. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You made the statement about the mothers having a different mindset than their mothers. Is that what you said?
Well, demographically, there's changes. And just to speak to that, I'm sure Dr. Davis won't mind if I answer. But basically, one of the things that, of course, has happened over time when you step back is there are more and more women in the workforce. Traditionally, when we first started, there were fewer women in the workforce. People that would give more time and make more time available for volunteerism. So one of the challenges is that a system really run and populated by predominantly older women, the populations that provide services, we need to, as I mentioned, reinvigorate the discussion and make volunteer opportunities as flexible as possible so we can tailor them to the way people live their lives.
Okay. And I think we have to start with the daughters as well.
Absolutely.
And I think that more and more schools are asking or requiring even community volunteer service as part of their program. I mean, that's something that is a trend, and I think that's important that people learn from an early age that they do volunteer.
Well, don't forget the sons.
Mr. Chair, the Portland Youth Jazz Band has as their theme, "This Isn't Your Mother's," or maybe it's "This Ain't Your Mother's High School Band."
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, we have come to the end of the public testimony. We'll close the public hearing and open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 792 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 792 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes. This bill should be funded.
just one disappointment, Mr. Chair. I think for the first time in a decade, I'm not one of the sponsors.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Bonnie Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Marquette?
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 792 will go to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much. We will close the work session and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 956. 956. Speaker list coming here soon. And would you like to talk about 956, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 956 requires the Department of Human Services to provide nursing facility, institutional, or home or community-based services to needy individuals who are not able to live independently without serious risk of harm. The individual is not able to carry out the activities essential to healthy, safety, and well-being. It declares an emergency effective on passage and also has subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Jim Davis and Garvin Rader. Who would like to go? Jim, would you like to go first?
Sure, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, Oregon State Council, retired citizens, Save Oregon Seniors, and United Seniors. And we come before you today to urge your support of Senate Bill 956, which directs the Department of Human Services and through the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division to make changes in administrative rules around eligibility, determining eligibility for long-term care services in our model long-term care system through what many of you have heard about is service priority rules or service priority levels. And these are levels through rules to determine eligibility for services in nursing homes and community settings, assisted living, residential care facilities, spousal pay programs, Oregon Project Independence, things such as that. What we want to do with this legislation is to amend to have the department directed to make appropriate amendments that would add additional factors to be considered in evaluating the individual's needs for services and putting certain emphasis, greater emphasis that my colleague will be able to explain in more depth, but greater emphasis on certain factors and clarifying the ability of an individual to appeal if denied services. Currently, the eligibility of an applicant is determined by using a standardized assessment tool and looking at the activities of daily living. On the books, they're listed 1 through 18 in terms of the service priority levels, but as you know, only 1 through 13 are now allowed to be eligible for services. But if an individual is denied services, he or she has the right to request an administrative hearing to challenge the accuracy of that assessment under the rules. However, there's no real provisions in the regulation that allow an individual to demonstrate that, regardless of the service priority level determined by DHS, that he or she cannot live independently. So there's some certain factors that we want clarified. The current rules do not make it clear that individual has the right to present medical evidence or an independent assessment. So we feel that legislative action is needed because we don't think DHS has been able to implement any of the recommendations of the survival priority level work group. And we have attached a little description of some of their work. And so at this point, I would like to introduce, if I might, Mr. Chair, Garvin Rader, who is a member of the board of Parkinson's Resources of Oregon. And he's a senior law attorney, and he helped us write this legislation and probably would be able to address points that I wouldn't.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morris. I appreciate it. I'm a practicing elder law attorney, and I volunteer for Parkinson's Resources of Oregon, and I do these hearings where somebody's been denied medical eligibility for Medicaid. We're talking about people that don't have any money. They're eligible for Medicaid financially. Nevertheless, they very often are denied coverage and are asked to leave care facilities quite frequently because they do not meet the quite restrictive medical eligibility requirements in the service priority rules. The two biggest areas that we see again and again, first and foremost, the inability to manage medication in and of itself is not considered a medically qualifying disability. You can't live alone. You cannot manage your meds. You need assistance. That in and of itself should be sufficient to qualify for assistance under the Medicaid program, and it is not, and SPD will vigorously contest those types of cases, and we do go to hearing on those, and I can't point to anything in the rules or statutes that says this person cannot manage their meds, cannot live independently. I can bring on witnesses. I can prove that this person can't live independently, and I still lose my case. Number two, the biggest other issue is managing complex medical conditions. There need to be something in the rules that allow us to look at the range of medical impairments. Maybe not something that in and of itself is on the is a listed impairment, but when you look at them all together, it adds up to a situation where somebody cannot live independently. That is not in the rules as they currently stand, and we have addressed that through the concept of managing complex medical conditions. Now, there's other things that are in there, too. I find another problem is the rules focus on the inability to eat, but not the inability to prepare meals. So somebody who cannot prepare their own meals, this is obviously somebody who cannot live independently, nevertheless, is ineligible for Medicaid, barring some other eligibility factor, unless they actually need assistance chewing or swallowing food. The rules are extremely restrictive on those areas. So that's what we see just on the eligibility side. On the in terms of the hearing right, it's not clear when you go to the administrative hearings, as I do, that you have the right to produce independent evidence to demonstrate that you meet any of the service priority rules or that you cannot live independently, and we would like to have that be our standard. We want to be able to have an administrative law judge take an independent look at this person and be able to conclude lawfully this person can't live alone and therefore qualifies for services.
Question.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Anderson.
So if this bill passes, it would give an individual who's denied service the right to representation. So who pays for that representation? What would this bill means? Who?
Well, certainly the bill wouldn't address. It's not. There's no funding for hiring an attorney or something like that. Probably most of the lawyers that would take these on would be legal aid attorneys. That I used to work at legal aid, and I did. Back then we didn't have this matter exactly, but legal aid would do it. And there are, in my practice, which is as a, you know, just a private firm, other family members will often pay for legal representation. I think it's important that the bill establish that as a right, but certainly we're not asking for a source of funding for an attorney.
So, yeah,
I
had another follow-up.
Yeah.
Sometimes I have had... Well, I know of two women who were told to leave a residential facility, and they did go back, and they had family. They actually did have family. But you're not talking about those who really do have family, but it's far easier to... I mean, it's nice for the LODDs. Some of them really like these residential facilities. They're so nice, provide wonderful opportunities and peer support and activities.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, there are a lot of people who don't have families, and there really is no solution. I mean, I am sorry to have to tell that to people when I talk to them as their lawyer, that I don't have any sort of solution for you. If we don't win at this hearing, you know, they have the right to evict you from this care facility, and there is often no answer as to what happens next. I think what ends up happening, and what I would advise a client, is you need to move into a private apartment without any care, and it's only a matter of time until there's a fall, there's a problem managing medication, some sort of medical emergency or catastrophic event is eventually going to happen, and then you're going to qualify under the rules, and then you'll be back on Medicaid and you'll be back in the facility. That's about all the advice that I have for a lot of these clients.
Senator Verger and then Senator
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
they probably won't be back in the facility because the facilities in my district are not accepting Medicaid. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, the one that owns the facility that we just heard about up north has notified the state now that they have 17 facilities. So I don't know that your bill is going to really help anyone.
I hear that loud and clear, Senator Verger. Trust me, I think that's a huge problem. I would say probably more assisted living facilities are shutting their doors to Medicaid clients rather than nursing homes. This bill would apply not only to assisted living facility residents but also nursing home residents. But you're absolutely right. Somebody who probably needs a nursing home level of care probably does qualify under the rules in most cases. So
from the Medicaid.
But you're absolutely right. It's a huge problem. But that being said, I practice in Portland. There's still a number of facilities that take Medicaid, and what we're dealing with very often are people that are already in these facilities, and they're going to get evicted. And what this is designed to do is sort of maintain the placement for the people who are already there to a large degree.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Verger. You and I must have been thinking the same way again, because I pulled out 766, Senator Morissette's bill, and said, well, we better be developing a crisis shelter center with all of these services. So what you're telling us is a lot of these people that may get moved off the system may, in fact, be on the street.
Some end up homeless if they can't qualify for subsidized housing, which, as you probably know, there's waiting lists for subsidized housing, but that's probably where I would tell somebody to go if they were evicted from an assisted living facility. We're talking about low-income people. I'd have them apply for subsidized. In fact, I would tell them to apply for subsidized housing the day I see them, just to get on the waiting list, even though it might take a while to get a result, because that's probably the only option for a lot of people.
Can I do a follow-up on that?
Yes, follow-up.
When I look at what you're describing of this needy individual who is at serious risk of harm, they may not be able to make that connection. Can you say, go to a certain agency? I don't want to be continuing to push this one bill. But, I mean, is it easy for a person who maybe it's not easy?
It's not easy, Senator George. I mean, you put your finger on it. Subsidized housing is a good example. I mean, up in Portland, you can't go to one place and apply for subsidized housing. You have to go to a number of different facilities and apply at, every place that you're interested in. It's really a mess, particularly in that area. And that Medicaid is not like that. I mean, if you're going to apply for Medicaid, you're going to go to the county services office. But once, what we're talking about is people who are no longer getting Medicaid, and now very much so. They are on their own. There is not really any centralized place where they can go to find out about housing benefits. Absolutely true.
If I might, in going back to Senator Verger's remark as well, and it is a major problem, the number of facilities that are pulling out of Medicaid, and one that it will become so serious that we'll have to start dealing with it on a policy level. But I also wanted to just comment to the fact that we're talking about a range of services here. We're not just talking about those in nursing homes. We're really talking about those qualifying for a range of community-based services, in-home services, other community-based facilities. So I think this will have a tremendous impact in terms of getting some people in who are being denied services that shouldn't be. This is just a system of greater fairness and justice.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Jim. Kind of gets the point. I was thinking back to a few sessions ago, and we had the battle over whether we were funding to 11 or 13. You remember that?
Oh, also. Yeah.
Okay.
And we got it back.
Yeah. Well, hard-fought battle. I mean, so is this in conjunction with that? I mean, the struggle is over the category of need at this point. And so you might have a case where somebody should be in an assisted living facility, but they're saying, no, they can do okay with home care. I mean, that's the sort of debate we're talking about.
Well,
there.
I'm glad you brought that up, Senator Cruz, because it's really important to note that if they lose their eligibility under the rules as they're currently written for an assisted living facility, they are not eligible for at-home care. the standard is for any care, be it in your home, be it in assisted living, or a nursing home. You're either on that list or you're not. And so when they find that you are not, you know, impaired enough under the rules, you're out of the system. And so there is not really...
So you wouldn't go from a 9 to a 10. You'd go from a 9 to a...
Dude, you'd be gone. You'd be off the list. I mean, that's what we're talking about, is this... The criteria themselves are so restrictive that many people are falling through the cracks.
Senator George.
On the second page, lines 6 through 9, are you telling me that today the person is denied eligibility and that they are not entitled to be noticed? And they have not necessarily an opportunity for contested case.
They do. I mean, they do have the right to a hearing under current law. Really, the intent of the statute is to give them the right to bring in independent evidence.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they do have the right to a hearing.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Case. And Rob, would you come up, please? There it is. James, do you want to bat clean up, or do you want to go ahead?
Mr. Chairman, it's totally up to you.
Go ahead, James. Go for it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves. I administer the Senior and Disability Program at the Department of Human Services. I don't disagree with a lot of the previous testimony. In 2003, in the five different special sessions, we ended up eliminating a whole bunch of the service priority levels. Originally, Oregon had an assessment set of levels that went from 1 to 18, with 18 being the lowest level of impairment to 1 being a person that needs almost total care. And some years ago, level 18 was eliminated. We were forced to, actually, by the federal government, and that included even some of the conditions of managing one's own meds. But in the 2003 set of special sessions, we eliminated services for levels. Originally, we proposed 10 through 17 to get to the budget targets. And then some of those levels were restored, and actually the current eligibility is 1 through 13. And we've actually tried to do the best we can to track what's happened to people after that time. And so you have two different sheets which show different sets of clients where notices went out, and then trying to track them over multiple years to see actually of those who originally were determined not to be eligible anymore, how many ended up with no services at all, or others that ended up in different parts of the service system. It was an extraordinarily painful time, I think, for everybody, for our clients, for our partners, for our field staff. And in many ways, we ended up using an eligibility tool that originally was really designed to help do care planning, and converted that into a very discrete eligibility tool for either admitting people to services or denying services. At this point in time, we are serving about 28,000 people in levels 1 through 13. We have no way. We just started playing with some numbers. We don't have a precise fiscal impact at this point if we added these service priority levels back. If we got back to about 5,000 people, roughly, that were in those categories that were deleted and sort of restored them to what the equivalent service levels were at that point in time, plus as being part of eligible for long-term care, they were also eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. But roughly, you would have about a $40 million general fund impact to restore that entire group for a full biennium. So that's kind of the range of folks that we're talking about. We have talked at length in the long-range planning process about folks with lower impairment levels, because the gentleman that spoke before is absolutely accurate. When you cut services to people with at that point in time less impairment levels, it is probably inevitable that they will come back into your service system at some point in the near future or longer term future, and they will probably come back at more expensive levels with heavier care needs than if you had provided the service all along. And I think we all knew that would occur at the time these pretty difficult changes were made. And as you can see, just glancing at this chart, in fact, that did occur. A lot of people over time have come back into the service system because of that. Again, in the long-range planning process, we have talked about envisioning whether it would be Oregon Project Independence or a similar fund where we would make a larger general fund commitment to people at lower impairment levels, even though we've been much more restrictive in terms of the Medicaid program and all the benefits that come with the Medicaid program. And I think at some point we're hopeful that we're going to start rethinking our financing and not rely completely on the federal program and federal match, but could actually, and actually I think most of us believe that if you provide that key support, even if it's not a full Medicaid wraparound for people at lower impairment levels, in the long run that will save the state money, and they won't come into our system later at higher care needs and costs. But with that, that's the data, and we're still working on a fuller fiscal impact, and it would depend on if we did this and when we phased it in and all of that. But just as a ballpark, it would be about a $40 million general fund cost to restore all these levels, which obviously isn't in the current governor's budget.
Now, that's what you see this bill doing, is restoring all the levels.
Mr. Chairman, the language isn't precise, but actually, well, it is actually pretty precise, but yes, the impact, if you look at the criteria in terms of the conditions mentioned, the addition of medication management, et cetera, in effect, it would pretty well go towards restoring levels 14 through even the original 18 that CMS eliminated some years ago. That would be our read of it.
Okay. Questions? Okay. Thank you. Good idea. yes. This might be a good bill to send to Ways and Means and let us wrestle with
Mr.
it.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. if I could just add one additional comment that several of you referenced, that there is another issue, and it is very significant in terms of the growing disparity. I'm probably taking your lines away. The growing disparity between what we pay as a Medicaid rate for many of our community programs and the private pay rate. And that's why we're beginning to see parts of that system, I wouldn't say collapsing, but certainly in the early stages of potential collapse if we don't do something. We've done a reasonably good job in the last couple of years through the provider tax of increasing the nursing facility rate, through collective bargaining on the home care side. We've significantly increased the pay and wages and benefits, but it's sort of like the bookends. The middle part of our system, foster care, assisted living, residential care facilities, have not had cost of living adjustments or other Medicaid rate changes. So the whole system is starting to get out of whack. It's not a good logical continuum anymore. And we're actually doing a lot of work saying, what does that rate structure have to be? What percentage of the private pay market does it have to be to still be competitive? Or we're going to get more and more programs, as you referenced, that start giving notice that they're going to withdraw from the Medicaid program.
Do you see, well, if we phase a program like this in, I mean, that's something, that's a different approach, I guess, if we were to phase it in. And that would, depending upon how we phased it, it would certainly cost less. But I don't know if that's doable. That's something we have to think about.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not quite sure what position CMS would take at this point if we went back and tried to expand the Medicaid program. That's sort of uncertain.
You know, James, I can see how you can read what you read, and I think this could also be interpreted to say that we're restoring through level 16 as well. So, I mean, just throw it out there. I mean, you know, you say it's pretty precise language. It is, but all precise language is subject to interpretation, and it does talk about bathing and dressing, and one could assume that meant full assist rather than partial assist, you know, that sort of thing. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Von Sanderson.
There's only a certain amount of money, and if we expanded then all the services, does that mean that Medicaid reimbursement rate would have to go down for each person because we've now added more people into the system?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I mean, we certainly wouldn't propose that. If we started adding people back, we wouldn't simply try to dilute all the Medicaid rates for everybody else because, I mean, then you really would begin to see a collapse of part of your system. And even if people are eligible, if you don't have service providers open and willing to serve them, it's kind of pointless. So we certainly wouldn't propose expanding this population and just diluting Medicaid rates. We would have to, again, recalculate what the new Medicaid rates would be for whatever population was being phased back in.
Follow-up?
Yes.
I need to understand, truly the people need care, but we have this priority line, and because that's isn't the reason you changed is because we don't have enough money. So this wants to lower that or include all the priorities, and that I don't see how we can mandate something when we don't have the money to pay for it. Does DHS have a stand on this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, well, it's clearly not in the governor's budget. So I mean, clearly we can't support the bill with it not being in the proposed budget. And as I indicated, it would be in the ballpark, depending, you know, which level people really think would be required as to be restored by the bill. Again, our just ballpark out there is about $40 million in general fund, in addition that it would require to restore all of these levels.
And just another follow-up?
Yes.
So I thought that we had given authority by rule so that CMS could have the flexibility of determining where that line is. Wasn't that the intent with the Oregon Health Plan way back when, and now we're trying to change that so that you are mandated to cover everybody?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Mona Sanderson, that's on the Oregon Health Plan side. This is on the long-term care
and that's different
side.
It's
very different because what we do in our entire Medicaid program is we determine the eligibility, which in Oregon is almost exclusively based on assistance for daily living and those different levels. So, in fact, in 2003, when we did all the reductions, we reduced that level down to levels 1 through 14 and actually eliminated those other levels, and we then went to the federal government and requested that those levels be dropped from our Medicaid program to correspond with the budget reductions. So we also did reductions in terms of rates and didn't do cost of living and all that stuff, but essentially this is the group of people that are not eligible for any services at all. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, I mean, to me, I was thinking that, yes, we have the Medicaid, but then we had OPI, and hopefully that was going to be taking care of those that Medicaid couldn't. And what you're saying is it's not, or that's what testimony is saying.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator, I mean, OPI is an incredibly important program, but it's about $12 million, and it serves many people that are beyond these levels as well. I mean, it's even more expansive than this. It provides, you know, meaningful but pretty limited support to folks that don't even have impairments under these criteria.
Okay, we're going to have to move along. We have one more bill. Rob, would you, and then I have a suggestion after we're through. Would you?
Sure, and I'll be very brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Johnson, and I'm with the Oregon Healthcare Association. I just wanted to be here today to put OHCA's support for the bill on the record. I think that it's becoming more and more important to provide for Oregon's frail and vulnerable seniors as they become a larger and larger percentage of our population. And I think Senate Bill 956 goes a long way toward ensuring that those folks have the services, have access to the services that they need. So,
thank you. Okay, thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing. But before anybody leaves, what I would like to do is work with some of the proponents and with James and look at an amendment before we go to Ways and Means. I'm afraid if it goes to Ways and Means as is, it will be all or nothing. I would like to look at implementation date, explore some of the possibilities. I'm on the Ways and Means subcommittee, and I would like to see it have traction when it gets there and not be an all or nothing thing. And so maybe we can think of some innovative word, you know, language that would appeal to the committee, because we have a lot of we have a lot of things to fund, and I think this is extremely worthy, but let's make it more attractive than it is right now with the idea that we will get something. So with that, we will close the public hearing. We have one more.
You double closed it.
I double close it. The last bill that we're going to hear is Senate Bill 996. This bill will be amended, so we will hear some testimony. And Nicole and Rob, would you please come back up, and we will start with you. And then Jerry Cohn, would you please come up as well? Keep in mind, the bill is going to be amended to narrow the scope. Oh, Bill, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. Rob, why don't you start where you left off?
Sure. Glad to be back. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Johnson. I'm with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent long-term care facilities across the state of Oregon, including skilled nursing facilities, assisted living and residential care facilities, licensed in-home care agencies, and independent senior housing. We recognize the need to plan for the boom in Oregon's senior population over the next 20 years, and Senate Bill 996, I think, is a step in the right direction. Oregon is expected to have the fourth highest percentage of citizens over the age of 65 out of the 50 states by 2025. The strain that this will put on our social service system is immense, but without preventative planning for those citizens who aren't Medicaid eligible, the strain could become even worse. Oregon's system of home and community-based long-term care services is a model in the U.S., and evidence shows us that per senior, Oregon is among the lowest in cost to provide care in the nation. This is due primarily to efforts to bolster our in-home care, in-home and community-based care services, which in the long run, as James said earlier, stave off the need for some seniors to require care in skilled nursing facilities, more acute care, and inevitably a more expensive option than community-based care. Senate Bill 996, I think, goes a long way toward planning for an increased senior population in the context of maximizing the benefits of our home and community-based care services. Seniors also have much to offer to their communities. With life experience comes expertise, and Oregon can utilize the expertise of its senior population to encourage volunteerism and mentorship. Young people, myself included, have a lot to learn from the life experiences of Oregon seniors, which is one of the areas that Senate Bill 996 helps to ameliorate. Planning for future changes in Oregon's senior population is a prudent step toward managing necessary services and balancing the increase in demand with the resources available to us. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 996, and thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of it.
Thank you, Rob. Nicole.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Pommetier. I'm here on behalf of O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. I think I almost forgot what that meant. We're here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 996 and to thank Senator Johnson for sponsoring this bill for us. As you'll hear today from, you know, our colleagues and friends here, we all have heard about the baby boom wave that's coming. People are aging into older Oregonians now, and it's going to be quite a wave. My mom is not a fan of me reminding her of that, but that's just the way it is. All of us sitting here at the table in the associations and organizations we represent have spent a lot of time in the interim looking at the future of long-term care and what's going to happen and what are the critical needs of the system. And from O4AD's perspective, we don't want that conversation to stop because it's here now. And we're going to start seeing these people come to need services, but also this is a chance for us to be, instead of reactive, to be proactive and not only look at the service side of it, but also, as Rob was mentioning, how to utilize expertise and experience, how to engage people in volunteerism. Workforce development is also another large area that we're hearing from the seniors that we serve. How do I continue working? I need to, I want to, I'm not ready to finish, but the workforce isn't quite matched to my skills, or I'm not matched to that. How do we do that? How do we make sure that we have the opportunities to utilize that within our state as we're trying to build our economy? It's a tremendous impact we can have there. We do support this bill. We are working with Senator Johnson's office on amendments that look at some pilot projects in terms of making this go out into the different communities to make it a little more manageable, a little more bite-sized. But we support the goals and intent of this and ask that it moves on to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jerry?
Chairman Morissette, distinguished committee members, I'm Jerry Cohen, Gerald J. Cohen, to be official so my parents are pleased. I'm a resident of Lake Oswego, and I'm state director for AARP, an organization that we all hope continues to celebrate birthdays. We're a membership organization of over 38 million, over half a million here in Oregon. And suffice to say, we strongly support this bill for all the reasons articulated, but I'd like to emphasize a few key points that we like about it and some ways to enhance it. And I know the chair has already referred to amendments, and we certainly hope that these comments are taken into the amendment process. First and foremost, we of course see this as building upon the great work that's been done by several task forces in the past. The current one chaired through the Seniors and Persons with Disabilities, but also the work done under then Governor John Kitchen. Quite a few bits of information and work that took place at looking at what has been labeled as a tsunami of boomers, although I think it's more like wave after wave after wave. First and foremost, again, praise the work here that calls for comprehensive planning, public and private sectors, and in particular the embrace of values of aging and what it offers in terms of economic development. And as Senator Montes Anderson already stated on the RSVP bill, the opportunity for individuals like nurses, where we have a shortage in the workforce, of creative ways to maintain and sustain and utilize the expertise of nurses and other areas of expertise that as aging boomers offer, continue to offer to the economy of Oregon. Let me hit a few points, and I'm going to just jump out of order in terms of prioritizing from our perspective what can be enhanced here. Looking at the Section 2, which articulates a number of things that should happen through this planning process, what we feel needs to be upfront and funded is the fact that we need strong research, evaluative support for this entire process. If it's truly going to be meaningful, if we're going to look at adjustments that need to be made periodically in terms of the plans that we're talking about. To that end, and I'm encouraging the committee to look at the resources that are homegrown here in Oregon. While AARP can certainly offer quite a bit, when you look at the Portland State University's Institute on Aging and the PSU Center for Population Research and Census, to me it just seems like a very common sense approach to utilize the resources we have and not expect that all the work has to and should be done by state and or local community employees.
Now, would you say that was comparable to a term that you often use, like a no-brainer?
I could. I'll allow that to the discretion of the chair, but I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, I really liken this to our Healthy Start program. And I truly feel we have to do this, because I take a look at the three previous bills, all asking for money, but this really hit me. We need to be developing strategies to decrease dependence on state-funded services, but then in addition, develop strategies so to encourage a public-private collaboration on these, and truly each committee or each region or agency on area agency on aging will be able to determine that, I would hope, and they should be made to do that, so we can start, you know, looking at ways to decrease, because the money is not going to be there.
Well, Senator Monitz Anderson, I appreciate your comments, and I want to point out to you and the committee that indeed we want to make sure we do this right. We want to make sure that we really are looking comprehensively. And that does require, at the front end, some investment, but ultimately look at what is going to really sustain and work for the state of Oregon. So I couldn't agree more, and I think that part of what we see is what was missing here was the need to build in the effective support for the planning and the evaluation and the adjustments, because as we know, baby boomers from one end of the spectrum, my brother and I tease a bit, he was born in 1946, I'm a 52 baby, and I have a sister who's a little older, younger than me, so I can say that there's a little difference when you start looking at a broad, almost 20-year difference in terms of that baby boom. So the adjustments that have to take place, we need to build into as well. I'll continue on with just a couple other quick points that I have in the written testimony, and just point out that you did refer to the need to look at diverting populations from state-funded services. We do have a little concern about that language, that in reality, what we're talking about really gets back to the values we're espousing in Oregon, and you asked some very good questions of the last bill around the issue of long-term care in Oregon, and Oregon has been the lighthouse of the country when it comes to putting in the statute back in the 1970s those very core values of dignity, health, honor, dignity, and choice. So we want to make sure we're focused on that in terms of what we're talking about as an outcome, particularly looking forward for an aging population.
Now, we're going to have to, we've got three more witnesses.
Sure. So
you do have,
we have my,
section 2, 1, section 2, 9,
yes.
section 2, you have four recommendations. Go ahead
we
and
do.
Continue.
Well, I'll just jump to then Section 2, Number 9. Just, again, a concern of the wording that right now would focus on, well, we need to get people to buy long-term care insurance, where at the moment, while it certainly is an option, both research and popular media have reported concerns as to, for many, whether it is both practical and affordable. So let's be real and let's expand what we're really talking about, are individuals taking personal responsibility for looking at what I can do to invest for my future. And that's much broader than, quick, buy long-term care insurance. And it may be developing the tools to help do for a consumer to compare. And last but not least on our comments here, hopefully not seeming too self-serving, would be the fact under Section 3. There are a number of outstanding organizations mentioned by name. We certainly would like to think that the resources that AARP, half of our members are baby boomers, maybe kicking and screaming, but we're there. Is a resource that can be at the table formally to provide support here. So those are my comments.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We have three more. Bob Lawrence, would you come up, please? Jim Davis and James Case, would you come up again? Okay, we have about 7 or 8 minutes, so we're going to have to be fairly brief. The good thing about this room is it's occupied at 5 o'clock, reoccupied. The bad thing about, is it reoccupied? No, we go somewhere else. Okay, but the bad thing is that we're on a time crunch, but we don't go somewhere else tonight, so we have a little bit extra time.
I do.
No,
oh.
I do.
Okay, you've heard from the committee. We go somewhere else at 5 o'clock. Okay. Senator George and I will stay until... I think we'll have to get out of here. Okay, go ahead.
We've done it before.
You're up.
James has decided that it would be okay if I went first, Senator
sure.
Morissette, and members of the committee. I am Bob Lawrence. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. And I am here very pleased to support the Baby Boomer Preparation Act. On behalf of the commission, I would like to express our appreciation to Senator Betsy Johnson for introducing this bill, which we see as a critical investment in the future and to start the dialogue with the legislature and stakeholders. When Governor Kulikowski charged the commission with holding meetings around the state, he said, "The time to prepare for this situation is now," and we agree. The Governor's Commission on Senior Services supports the idea of a small number of pilot sites to begin to implement a planned approach to addressing the needs of the aging population. We know that some communities in our state are ready to begin this work. And I am a resident of Lake Oswego with Jerry Cohen, and we in Lake Oswego, the community of Lake Oswego, embarked on a city-funded and supported what we called the 50-plus dialogue, which was to address the needs of the baby boomer population that was coming on. The steering committee on this, reflecting on Jerry's comments, the steering committee that was set up because these dialogues had never been done before anywhere in the country was Merrillhurst University, Portland State University, AARP, Clackamas County Social Services, Lake Oswego Adult Center, Elders in Action, and Civic Ventures from San Francisco, which exclusively deals with the engagement of baby boomers in their communities. This was such an interesting process because we trained over 30 community people that had volunteered. How do you do dialogues? How do you facilitate? How do you communicate? And how do you gather information? What we came up with was Debbie Elliott of Portland State University compiled an analysis of the comments, which became part of the final report and part of the platform for next steps. The heavy policy issues identified in these dialogues were affordable housing, transportation, volunteerism, how do we volunteer, what do we volunteer for, and intergenerational activities. As people age, they do not want to be isolated from the younger generation. The city of Lake Oswego has now set up a 50-plus dialogue advisory committee to work on implementing the recommendations in the report and developing a comprehensive set of tools and strategies to address the future needs. In other words, we're ready to go on to the second step. This bill, as introduced, may not yet be the perfect piece of legislation, but it is a perfect focal point to begin a dialogue amongst legislators, the governor, the Department of Human Services, stakeholders, advocates, and other service providers to help ensure a future of hope and opportunity for all Oregonians. And that is my testimony, and the citizens that participate in the dialogues had never done that before, and they just came away pumped. They were ready. What are we going to do next? So it was a very good experience, and I would hope we could extend that to other communities in the state.
Could we get the report of Debbie Elliott from PUC? Is that report?
Senator Morris said yes, and we can also provide the 50-plus dialogue report.
Okay, I think that would be good. We're going to come back to this bill after we get the
answer. Thank you.
May I ask a question? What kind of dialogue is taking place in this? It sounds to me like you're planning for people to really need your services. And I'm wondering about that because my children are the baby boomers, and I'm not planning on them using your services. I'm teaching them how to be independent and not have to use your services. And so I'm a little confused by this, I have to be honest with you.
I think Senator Verger, the intent of the dialogues, and that's they were set up by Portland State and the research group, was to say, what services do you perceive that you're going to need from your community? And it was very interesting, because the primary thing is that they said they would not want to go to the adult center because that's for old folks. So we are looking at activities of volunteerism. How can they contribute? How can they plan for retirement and things like that? And if services are available, what happens when the services are available? In other words, what do they expect from their community?
One quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, and I really hope that you're going to be dealing with a population that has really been interested in nutrition and in walking and exercise and in prevention and health care, and that maybe you're not going to see what you have seen in the past generations. I would hope so. I'm not opposed to planning, but I'm opposed to planning in order to keep services growing and more people coming on and the encouragement of that. I would like to see you doing the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. One of the problems, we have an obesity problem in our society, and that's a relatively new problem, relatively. And people maybe won't live as long to access the services because of the obesity problem, but there are conditions that may be beyond the control even of the individual who has a condition, even though they want to correct it. I mean, so there are some situations where people are going to be accessing services, and in spite of the fact that we try to teach them to be self-sufficient. But Jim, you want to go briefly and then
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis, representing the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, Save Oregon Seniors. We are just here to strongly support this piece of legislation. As a gerontologist, I can tell you that there's nothing we need to plan for more than the explosion, the boomer explosion, where we're going to see the senior population double. And so I totally agree with Senator Verger that we need to be looking at different ways of approaching the boomer population, and prevention is one of the key things that needs to be done. And we will see tremendous decreases in the amount of money we have to put into our system because of that. But the fact is, when the population is doubling, we have to look at how we're going to provide services for this population. And our belief is that the boomers deserve the same national model system of community-based long-term care that their parents got. But we have to plan for this. We have to know how the system will change. And the boomers are a different population, and they'll have different needs, and there'll need to be different approaches and different ways of looking at it. And this kind of planning process is absolutely essential. And I might add that what is very important in this process is that everybody within the senior and disability communities and everybody within the general community be involved. In other words, making sure that consumers as well as grassroots advocates be involved in the process to a great extent.
In addition to obesity, which seems to be a cause of Alzheimer's, Alzheimer's itself seems to be either growing or we're becoming more aware of it, and if people live longer, which they are they living a quality life? I mean, to live to be 95 and have Alzheimer's from the time you turn 70 is not a quality of life situation, and so there are many things that are going to happen to people that we... even with the best of mine. It's a difficult thing, and that's the other thing. People are living longer, but is the quality of life any better? Some people, in fact, the suicide rate among seniors is suddenly out of sight now. I mean, we're realizing that too, so it's a quality of life thing. James.
Mr. Chairman, James Tays, Department of Human Services. I will be extremely brief. I pulled some charts and graphs out of the current draft of the long-range plan that a large task force has been working on for several years, and it displays demographically what the population expansion is going to be. And we even did some preliminary estimates. If we just trended forward some of the population numbers, what it would mean in terms of increases in service capacity and required spending and all that. And I think the long and the short of it is we can't simply sit back, wait, and think we can buy or grow our way out of this issue. The potential cost to the state is enormous, and even if we can afford the long-term care that we really want, there's a real question whether the workforce itself will be available in sufficient numbers to even be able to support people that need services. So part of the planning, the most essential part that is encapsulated in much of this bill, is to say, how do we get communities ready? How do we keep people independent, healthy, and safe for as long as possible to avoid that precipitating event
that often triggers a person's entrance into long-term care. And there are many wonderful plans and models going on around the country. What we want to do is figure out the best ones in healthy aging and diet and exercise and financial planning and volunteerism, and take the very best we can find and figure out how we take those to scale. Because you can look at models till the end of time, and anybody can do wonderful little research projects and models, but the issue is how we take those community preparedness models to scale and actually have a planning process in every community in Oregon that assures at least that those essential elements are there, that people get financial planning, that the awareness, and I think one of the biggest issues, if you look at what AARP and some others have done in terms of surveying people, most of the boomers or many boomers aren't planning, don't even think about it. So we really have to create a very powerful awareness that we have to sort of seize control of our own destinies, plan as much as possible, and have tools, have ready-made tools that are available for us to do that. So I think the concepts in this piece of legislation are very compelling. You know, we're going to have to work on some of the issues in terms of how we actually fund this kind of planning process over time. But this really, to answer the senator's question, is we're not simply planning to expand the service system. We're looking at every strategy possible to keep people as healthy and safe and independent in their own homes for just as long as possible. So,
I'm currently reading a book by Andrew Wiles, the physician that deals, and he's dealing with aging. I'm reading about myself now. And I'm reading about how my body has changed and is continuing to change, and how important it is to be aware of the changes of aging. And there is no anti-aging medicine out there, but there is quality aging, and that's what we're all talking about, is how do you figure out what the best way is for you to age in a quality way. And I agree wholeheartedly. That's what we have to deal with. Yes, Senator Jordan.
Mr. Chairman, I've looked at these graphs, and I think we'll need to re-refer this bill to emergency preparedness.
Oh. Good.
Oh, very good, Gary.
Okay. Some of us are on that committee. Close the public hearing. We will adjourn before Monta Sanderson gets out the door. We've adjourned.